Big welcome to any visitors to us, and a huge welcome to any newcomers that might be with us tonight. For whatever reason, we hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. We are a speaker meeting, and it falls to me to introduce our speaker this evening. I first met this person in the course of service that I do on a committee, who'd rocked up to ask for some help and guidance about how to start a fellowship going through the pandemic in an isolated place. And I was just massively impressed by this individual's willingness to just take the information and go away and run with it and do what they've done. And I've been to their meeting once or twice in the last short while, and it's a really amazing story. I just identify so much with what they're going through in the community that they live in. And I just really felt it would be lovely to invite them to come and share with us. So, without further ado, I'm going to invite Jacqueline to share her experience, strength, and hope with us for 40 or 45 minutes, whatever she's comfortable with, on her journey to, through, and into Narcotics Anonymous. So, Jacqueline, the floor is yours. Please share with us and welcome to the meeting.
Hi, sorry, I was just trying to unmute myself. I'm not used to this format. I'm feeling a little bit nervous. Thank you, Steve, so much for that lovely introduction and warm welcome. And nice to meet you all through sound. And there's a couple of people in here I know, so that makes me feel very comfortable. Thanks for everyone who's done service. And if nobody gets anything from my share, I'll just say, as I've heard many times, stick around, you will hear it. And from my own experience, when I first started coming to these meetings, I felt a little bit like I didn't belong to begin with, because of hearing about different substances. But within a couple of weeks, I knew I was in exactly the right place. And now it's definitely home to me. So experience, strength, and hope. A bit about me. So I was born and bred in Guernsey, which is a little island closer to France than the UK, but we are part of the United Kingdom. We have about 65,000 people here, and I think in the historically NA was alive in Guernsey, and I think in 2013 they stopped for whatever reason. So we only had the other fellowship of AA running. I spoke taking a bit of time today to listen to a few of the recordings from this group, and it's very varied, and it's been very interesting. My story as a growing up as a child, I had a nice family. I wasn't put into care. I wasn't abused in the home. And yeah, I was very lucky in those circumstances. I did feel from like most stories I hear, feel very different. I was quite a chubby kid. I've got very bad eyesight, so I wear glasses which are very magnify your eyes to look big, say. So, every kid goes through bullying. There was a particular boy, a brother of my best friend who was quite a bit older than us, and he made my life hell, verbally, physically as well. And one time I got invited into, I think I was around 9 or 10, and they invited me to join them in their incest. And I can't say it was abuse because I was willing. I didn't know what I was getting into, I didn't know what was happening. It was probably the only time he wasn't verbally abusive to me, so it was a bittersweet experience. And I think for a long time I blamed that on my behaviours, my promiscuity in later years. And I certainly think it had a detrimental effect to the way I viewed sex and love, and sort of drugs in trousers was definitely a big part of my story, as well as all the rest of them. So I remember running around the school after that experience, trying to grab everyone's private parts. And I think now I've I work in a medical environment, and I've had to do some safeguarding courses, and you know these kind of things are flagged up, but years ago it wasn't. Anyway, I digress. So my first experience of getting high was when I had toothache, and my dad used to give me whiskey on cotton wool. My family are all big drinkers. I wouldn't say there's many alcoholics in my family. There's definitely a few. Yeah, it's a big culture of drinking. So I remember this whiskey on the old bit of cotton wool for the toothache, and I remember thinking, oh my God, I felt it. I felt the glow. I felt the hit in the shoulders. I felt how warm it made me feel, and I kept going back for more. And then, you know, in my young days, we would go out for dinner, and we'd be allowed to have glasses of wine. And I remember the first instant when I got quite merry, and we were on a holiday where we had bikes, and you know, I remember that just feeling like I felt like I fitted in when I had this. I felt the glow of the whole environment felt better. Everything was easier. I didn't feel so awkward, you know. And that carried on in my early teens. I was a compulsive people pleaser, and wanted to get involved in, you know, I always seemed to end up on the fringes of all the naughty thing goings on. And from booze it went to glue bag, petrol sniffing, worked my way through the party drugs. Luckily over here we don't have a massive heroin or crack cocaine problem. You still do time over here if you get caught with grams of cannabis. So you can imagine it's not very easy to get those drugs in, and it's a blessing. Although I think if we had something like, you know, opiates, if I could ever get my hand on any prescription meds, I was very happy to do that. And I think I would have definitely gone down that route if it had been available to me. So excuse me, I'm just going to get rid of my dogs. Where was I? Sorry, I was interrupted. So yeah, went down that route, but always with alcohol as well. And it was alcohol that gave me the worst consequences in my life. When I was about 18, all I wanted to do as an island girl was get off the island. It was boring. It was crap to be here. I thought I knew better. I thought, you know, I was destined for bigger things. And my first boyfriend when I was 18, he was quite a bit older than me, and he was not the first, not the best first boyfriend, shall I say. We ended up going off to live in London with his brother, who had been there for a few years in Wandsworth. And you know, it quite opened my eyes being pretty naive, Guernsey girl. He had me signing on in two different places in Brixton and somewhere else, and I had no clue what was going on. I never got in trouble for it, but you know, they weren't working, they were all criminals. I didn't stay long. I was pregnant there, and I had to make a decision. And we moved up to Peterborough at this time, and they got involved in some crime that really frightened me. And I thought, I can't live like this. And I decided to terminate the pregnancy, which I did, and then went back to Guernsey directly after. I was 18 at the time, and when I got back to Guernsey, I began to hemorrhage, and it was not worked properly. And what I saw was, and I'm sorry if it offends anybody, but this is my story. I saw something that looked like an arm. I was quite far gone. You know, I look back now, and I work in a place where I see young women coming in for this same procedure, and I've had to have EMDR because it actually triggered such a massive reaction in me when I saw, you know, that stage and that decision being made in front of me. You know, it's something I have a lot of compassion around from experiencing it. But I think after that, I was just in a in a massive place of denial and a massive place of wanting to bury emotions that I couldn't deal with. So that was sort of around the beginning of the rave scene and all the rest of it. And there was a lot of party drugs getting into Guernsey. And obviously alcohol was always on the agenda. So I went through that. I met my husband a few years later, and everything happened very, very quickly. I was about 25 when I met him. Within 9 months, I was pregnant. We got married, and we didn't really know each other. We were from quite different backgrounds. He had a very privileged upbringing, doctors, parents, and sent away to boarding school. So his sort of emotional needs were very different to mine. He was an addict. He was one of us, definitely. So you can imagine the carnage of that. We had our own home. All I wanted to do was party. I was a neglectful mother. When my first son was born, I think the reality of what I'd done had hit me, and I couldn't deal with it, and I wanted to run away. I was diagnosed with postnatal depression, but I think it was a lot to do with that experience at 18. I just wanted my house to be a party house. It wasn't a family home. My children have all suffered. I had two after that, and a couple of breakups in between. I'd gone to my dad's, the relationship broke down because I was doing what I've always done. And that is, thought about myself first, be promiscuous, just wanting to be hedonistic, not to face reality. Then we'd get back together. And then I had he left me for a while and I had a massive breakdown. My son was three at the time and witnessed a lot of things that a young child of that age shouldn't have. I think my family were just about to take the child, my first child, away from me. But luckily I have a massive support network of family and I've been so blessed with it that my mum ended up moving in and saved the day in that way. I got myself together. Well, we got back together as a marriage, and I had two kids after that, and our marriage lasted for 13 years. Again, it ended up in violence from the husband, from promiscuity on my side, and it just all broke down. And I left with the three children, and basically, like a monkey, went straight onto the next branch with the next person that I found that could be my enabler. And although I thought I had cracked it because I got away from the drug scene with my husband, I was in total denial about what alcohol was doing to me. And I spent the next 10 years with an alcoholic man. And now the children would go to their dad's every weekend. At the beginning, he had totally broke down. He started on heavy opiates and the business went to nothing. And I'm ashamed to say that I left him in a mess. I left him in a mess. And I really was so active in my addiction. I really didn't care. There's so much grief in recovery, isn't there? Because of all the things you get to realize of what person you were. It's a tough road, that step four and step five. It's a freeing and a beautiful step, but it's been tough. There's been a lot of grief because there's so much denial, and I buried it, to face who you are, who you were, should I say. Is a tough one. So I would drop the children at my ex-husband's, knowing full well that they probably weren't being looked after very well, just so that I could go out and party for the whole weekend. They would come home on a Sunday, fed and watered, and I would be in different states of consciousness. My mother's still living here. Me depending on her for lifts during the week. I was functioning. I kept the job. I don't know how. My sister was my boss. I think that was mainly what it was about. Their schoolwork, as long as they told me they were doing their homework, I was happy. I missed out a lot of parents' meetings. I didn't beat my kids, and I probably didn't say horrible things to them, but I was just neglectful and I was inappropriate. My addiction, especially the men in the drugs in trousers, took me down some seedy avenues, and I got into with this chap of 10 years, got into a lot of sex parties, etc., which were, always either out of the house or when the children were out of the house. But inevitably, come the end of that 10 years, things got worse. And one time I brought it home, and this brought me to my knees. Before I tell you the rock bottom, I'd been and out of the other fellowship for probably from 97 onwards. I'd get a couple of weeks here, a couple of weeks there. The first one was because of the breakdown. I wanted to do it for my family. It wasn't for me. The second one was when I was about 2 years into the new relationship with the alcoholic, and I had fallen off my bike and was ended up covered in piss, shouting and screaming, stumbling around a car park near to where we live with a whole group of my 15-year-old son's friends filming it. And I got off with a caution, but I got arrested. I got put in the back of a van. I spent a night in a cell. And the worst part of that was that that video got posted to my son, and all, hundreds of people saw this video of me. And then I went back into the other fellowship and tried again, and it lasted a couple of weeks. I just couldn't. It was always for other people. I just couldn't do it until the final one, where I brought this inappropriate behaviour home. So my daughter heard some noises, and my partner was asleep on the sofa, and the noises were coming from my room. She didn't see anything, but she knew what was going on. And in her little mind at 15, she just thought it was all going to kick off, that I was going to be killed. And she left the home and went walking around the streets because she was so scared. It wasn't until years later, and I'm talking, in the last year or two, that she's had counselling because of all this and opened up to me. And as I said, she carried guilt for that night because she thought she'd done wrong by leaving me, that I might have got killed. Well, that wouldn't have happened, but she didn't wasn't to know that. I wouldn't have even at the time thought that she had those feelings. It's just insidious. So after that time, that happening, and I was in blackout. I wasn't even quite sure what exactly had happened until the kids came home the next day, and my eldest son sat me down after she had told him, and he said to me, "Mum, I don't give a fuck what you do, excuse my language, what you do with your life, but you're not gonna don't ruin, please don't ruin Millie's. And if I had the money and I had enough job, I'd get a flat and take her with me." And I had no excuses. I had nowhere to go. So I've been abstinent from alcohol since then. Sitting in those rooms still took me 2 years to actually do the work. It took me to start acting out sexually, to realize, to think, this is really scaring me, because I didn't think I'd act like this without substance. And it was suggested to me that I start doing the work, doing the steps, and that really started to really change me, started to bring some morals in my life, some spirituality, some guidance, some step for realization of what I was actually doing and how I was actually behaving. And that was pivotal in my recovery. And I really started to change then. Then in 2019, I think it was, I met my now partner, who's a lovely person. And I had an operation, and as a result of that, I started to get hooked on opiate meds again. And his late wife had died 3 years previously, so his house was like a candy shop to me, full of, fentanyl patches and bottles of Oramorph, etc., which I didn't take long to use. I just as the pandemic happened, a couple of series of things happened. I was really into, you know, using opiates. And I found myself at work trying to get into a sharps bin to retrieve the rectal diazepam that had gone out of date that I'd shoved in there the evening before. Now, if I'd been caught, I'd have lost my job. I've got a mortgage to pay, et cetera, et cetera. I didn't manage to break into it. I got some sense. I stopped doing it. Around this time as well, my partner's stepson of 41 died drug-related. And my middle son, Hamish, his best friend, was up 21, was sent into rehab. And I tried to share about this in the other meeting. And although it wasn't met with hostility, I had no identification, had no one to identify with, and it was just a very difficult time. And someone mentioned to me about Zoom meetings and finding NA and trying that. And so I eventually found some meetings. I can't remember my first one was Canterbury or somewhere like that. They were lovely people. And I felt the language they were speaking really spoke to me. You know, it all fellowship is good, but at least it's up to date. I thought this could reach, you know, my son's friend. I tried to get him to the other fellowship, but it's very old fashioned. Today we live in a society where, you know, sexism, you know, all those different things, the political correctness. I think it's difficult for people to understand that old fashioned literature and readings. So I just thought, wow, this is up to date. This is different. I felt really at home. I could really relate and identify with people's shares. And it was then that I thought, you know, we need something like this in Guernsey. I sent an email to World Services. I think it was World Services, and Stuart from Fellowship Development in Weymouth, I think it's Fellowship Development he's with, gave me a ring, and we had a little chat. By this time I sourced a venue, because the venues, I knew the venue from being in the other fellowship, and he sent me a link with a lot of shares, and I heard a girl share, and she just spoke to my heart, and I just thought, I really need, would really like to speak to her. And luckily managed to get her phone number, and she is in the Preston meeting. Her name's Lisa, and I'm sure a lot of you heard her share. And she helped me find a sponsor, and she gave me lots of information of what to do and what not to do. And I also phoned the NA line in Jersey, our sister island. And I spoke to a lovely guy who has been our secretary for the Tuesday meeting since. He's just about to give up the service, but we've become really, really good friends. And he helped me and a few others to, you know, get it all going. It was very exciting. You know, a lot of character defects come out when I was trying to get it all sorted. I was being very controlling. I learned so much about myself. I would have, if I hadn't had a sponsor and people to guide me, I would have probably pushed people away, because I was so panicking about perfection. I forgot what it was all about, you know. But luckily I was guided. And, you know, from there on, it's just been one God incident after another. You know, my clean date was, I was a year, 12th of May. So that's totally clean, not, you know, sitting in the other fellowship using opiates and saying I'm coming up for 5 years of alcohol abstinence, which, to be fair, like as you can see from my journey, is the worst, has given me the worst consequences anyway, and for my family. Life is much better, but life on life terms is hard, is still hard, but at least I have this toolbox now, which is getting me through. At the moment, it's the difficult time. My daughter's just told me she's self-harming, and it's very difficult to go straight to all about me, my fault, pity pot. I can't deal with this. I need, you know, a way out of this. But I don't, it doesn't have to be like that today. what I have to do is really work this program now at the moment, and you know, talk to my sponsor, which I do. And that took me a long time to get used to. You know, I thought, I'm just a pain in the ass. My little moans and groans aren't worth listening to. And she said to me one day, how do you know I don't need that call? You know, how do you know that? That my day might be shit. And, you know, and that sort of, it's all these little things that I've learned along the way that, you know, are helping me. Doing the service, my God. You know, they always say service, meeting, steps, sponsor. And it is so bloody true, because if I didn't have this commitment twice a week for doing service in Guernsey, I could so easily get complacent or isolate at the moment because of the way, you know, I could let myself go in this situation with my daughter. But instead, I've reached out. I've had information sent to me. The first night I shared about it, that meeting I went to, another woman did a share and she talked about self-harm. Can you believe that? You know, that is higher power in action, in, you know, the miracle of this fellowship. And the second meeting I went to, I took my daughter, and her story was started off with self-harm. Now, I don't know whether my daughter doesn't use substance, but she is definitely compulsive. She's a fantastic artist. She puts her mind to anything. She does it 100%. She isolates, you know, she's got a lot of the traits like us. So I thought she might get some ID from the meetings and hopefully catch it. But through the program, I've been sent information. I've read up on it. It's really helped me to deal with the situation and be there for her. And I think it horrifies me to think of how I would be dealing with this now if I was back there in active addiction. It absolutely horrifies me. And I'm so blessed because I can be consistent. If anything, the beauty of this situation is it's brought us all closer together. My partner now, I met through my daughter. They worked together and they were friends before I even got together. So rather than my normal, you know, grab one branch before I let go of the other, one bad relationship into another, all about, you know, what I can get out of it, you know, this is probably the first real relationship I've had. And she loves him to bits and trusts him. And it's brought us all together as a family. And, you know, I'm so, so grateful for finding the fellowship. Like all of us, I've been searching for so long for something to fill that void. And going back to 97, when I had the breakdown, I had two people come to me out of the blue. My house was like a party house. I was using them for the drugs and they were using my house to party in. But Jehovah's Witness knocked on my door, and a happy clappy Christian knocked at my door. And no disrespect to anybody, I love them equally. And they had no agenda. All they wanted to do was look out for me. And I promised I would, when I got myself shit together, I would go in to each of their churches. And I couldn't get on with the Christian one because it was just too lively. It was too noisy, and it just wasn't for me personally. But I thanked him, and I'm still friends with him to this day. And the other one with the witnesses, I did a 2 year, but I ended up doing 2 years of Bible study with them. And you know, it taught me how to taught me the power of prayer. If nothing else, just to get out of my own thoughts for that 10 minutes I was praying, it probably taught me about, you know, a few morals that I could hang on to. And it gave me so much peace. My mum used to come in and be so happy that to see me with some peace and serenity for a while. But it didn't stop me using. I couldn't commit to them because I didn't agree with everything that they were doing. And I just felt like I couldn't be that good, basically. But like I say, I would never slam the door in anyone's face, and they do good things. So I was always looking for something. I always believed in something. I never grew up with religion. I never, you know, I was lucky I wasn't forced with religion and found it hard to reconnect. So I'd never connected really with anything until I came into the rooms, and that's where I found my broad church. And this is why I think it's such a beautiful thing, because you know, there's so much conflict around religion, as we all know, and yet we can come and sit in rooms and your higher power is probably looks nothing like mine, you know, and I'm totally on with that, and I'm happy for you, and I feel that you're happy with me. When I talk, sitting here and talk and open my heart up about what's happening with my daughter, I know you're not going to judge me. I know you're going to understand, and I can't do that. I can't do that with my family. Some of the family, some because I want to stop. I don't want to tell my mum because I don't want her to over worry, and I know she will. And others, it will put me in a place of fear because I think I'll be judged. Maybe I'm not. Maybe that's just my own character defects. But I can come here and I can offload it, and I can feel, and it's proven that people have reached out to me and helped me deal with this. That, you know, even to go into a counselling situation, many hours of counselling in different forms, and yet the therapeutic value of one addict talking to another cannot be compared with. You know, to go and sit in a room with a young lady, a very nice young lady, who's just out of uni with a degree, it's just no match for what we can do for each other here. And that's why, you know, I'm happy to sit in that room, like I was saying to Steve earlier. Last week before last, was the first week I sat on my own in that room. And I think that's a really good thing, because when we started it off, I did think I was going to be, you know, a year, 18 months before the word got round and people started coming, and it's been good. And with the hybrid meeting of a Zoom platform, there's always about six people that come in. And in a small island, those people that come in will always keep it fresh and always bring something new to it. Being in a small island with the same group of people in the other fellowship, you know, it can become, you can become complacent. You can think, oh, you know, get impatient with the same old stories all the time. So, you know, it's difficult for the newcomer. And I'm so thankful to this fellowship, and I'm so thankful to the platform of Zoom by bringing everybody so close together, and for meeting so many people with such diverse backgrounds and their wealth of experience and hope and courage, you know, to be honest and talk about things and make me feel that I'm not such a freak, and that actually, you know, I'm on step six at the moment. I was about to read out my step six, and my sponsor said to me, we will we'll do the steps from the workbook. We'll do one a month, and then we'll go through the green and gold one a month. And I thought, you what? That's going to take me 2 years, you know? And I was thinking, no, I want it now. I want it yesterday. And, you know, that was then. This is now. And I understand, and I'm happy with it, because it's living it. It's living it. And you know, one day maybe I'll get the honour of being somebody's sponsor. And taking them through it, and I would do exactly the same way. And you know, it takes a long time for the penny start to drop with me, you know, and I'm sure as it does with others. And you know, I've done nothing much more than pray over the last couple of days, last couple of weeks with my daughter, and I get a lot of help from that, you know, a lot of serenity from being able to pray, to use, when I'm feeling fear, try and remember to use my faith. And I mean it, that's why I'm a work in progress. It's a practicing thing, isn't it? It's a doing it every day. I get up and I read the Just for Today, and I share it on our group, and then I do a gratitude list and I send it. At the moment, we've got eight girls that we send it to, and it's lovely to see people's gratitude lists really, you know, becoming real when they really get into it. And it's little things, and that's how I start my day. I wake up most mornings. At the moment, I wake up and I don't know what I'm going to see in the room next to me, and I just have to pray that everything's going to be all right. And I wake up, I've always had nightmares, so I don't wake up springing out of bed. But once I've sat and I've read the Just for Today, and I connected with the girls that I know, and I do the, you know, try to do the next right thing. I'm so, you know, aware of my character defects, my impatience, my intolerance, my rage. Just briefly, recently at work, I've been really overworked, And I'm trying to deal with that like an adult. And I snapped at somebody recently, and I really, I was really forceful with what I said, and it wasn't usual for me to be like that. So I think they were shocked, and I went away, and I sort of enjoyed the rage for a moment, and I enjoyed that I'd stood up to this person that, can be quite condescending. And by the time I'd got back to my office, I thought, what are you doing? That's so old behavior. And I sat down, and I probably should have been brave and go back and face her, but I sent her an email. And at first my addict saying, say you're really overworked, say somebody else had said something, la 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 la, and trying to manipulate so that it would, would get me off the hook. And I didn't. I just said, apologies for snapping at you. I appreciate it. Must be very annoying when the photocopy is left on. And I left it at that. And she went back to me, and I was really proud of myself. I thought, my God, this is adult behavior, and I would have been seething on that. If I'd been in active addiction, I would have been slagging her off, and I would have been being pathetic and childish. This is what I'm learning. I'm learning to do life, I guess, and I'm very grateful. I think I've been going on a bit now, so I hope it wasn't too all over the place. I hope you've got something out of it. And Steve, thanks very much for asking me and letting me share, and all the help that you've done and with us in Guernsey. So I'll leave it there. Thanks a lot.